title of our lesson today is Living the Word of Wisdom in a World That Does Not Live It. There are some things that are simple that I'm rather proud of in my life. One is that wine, beer, whiskey, tea or coffee has never passed through these lips of which I speak. I wish there were some other things for which I could make as broad and as bold a statement, but I have always taken some pride in that particular thing, and in my life there have been some narrow escapes in that regard. One of those occurring while I was in the armed services, when you're thrown into a kind of environment where the peer pressure on you to do things is really rather terrific. I'm sorry to say that I can't say the same thing about cigarettes. When I was at a very early age, probably only 9 years of age, the neighborhood swimming pool was on our farm, north end at the foot of our farm, and as you know, country boys all swim in the nude, and this old swimming pool, and I've talked with my brothers about this in recent years, it's interesting in some respects. We learn all the facts of life down at the swimming pool, more than we needed to know, really, you know. That's just the way things were. But in addition, in our particular case, I was the oldest one in the family. I think my younger brothers escaped this. But one of the fellows' uncle was a Chesterfield salesman, and somehow this kid got an entire crate, wooden crate, full of Chesterfields. I must have been 100 or more. Boxes. And they were hidden in a hollow tree down by our old swimming pool. And then I remember learning such things as, well, you smoke these and then you go eat new green onions so your parents don't know that you smoke them. Well, I was not particularly proud of that. I succumbed to the peer pressure to smoke some of those Chesterfields. But there was a young friend that I was quite fond of, red-headed, freckled as the Dickens, fairly new kid, came to school. I sort of fell for him as my friend right off, and we struck up quite a rapport. But he had smoked some of these too. We got talking about that one time, and we decided that we weren't going to participate in that anymore with these other guys, and we were going to make this a real permanent thing. So we got an old pan, and we pricked our fingers with this pan, and we got an old scrap of paper, and with our own blood we wrote on this little scrap of paper that never again in our lives would we ever smoke a cigarette. Both of us did that and signed that thing. And then we stuck that in a Prince Albert can. You guys don't remember these things about. It was real amazing, interesting things in the smoking business. There were cigar boxes, and they were really neat to have when you're a kid to keep your treasures in. Then there were Bull Durham sacks. Maybe they still have these things. I don't know. The string on it, you know, good to keep marbles and other things in. And then Prince Albert can, which had this lid that, you know, they're kind of shaped in cross-section like that, flip up there, and he's for putting things in, too. Well, we put this sheet of paper, we'd sign in blood that we wouldn't smoke again, in this Prince Albert can, and then we buried it there at the old swimming pool. I'd like to go back and see if it's still there. I guess all rusted away. So, at least for me, I lost track of that friend. At least for me, that did end that aspect of some of the kids, that things that kids will do in fooling around with some of these things. In the Navy, the pressure of the situation there, sometimes you can't explain. was a big Navy dinner. I was a minor naval officer, as low as you can be. I was an ensign during World War II. That's the bottom. But there was an officer's banquet of some kind. I was stationed in Honolulu, Hawaii at that time during the war. At this officer's banquet with the other officers who were my friends, they of course served liquor of various kinds. Now they, one thing they had was something I think they called it a cordial. It was a little thing about that high and kind of a syrupy dark colored liquid in that, and the guys talked about it. This was so much percent alcohol and whatnot. And the other drinks I was against, but they kept telling me, well, I won't hear you drink this one, Hall. You know, you ought to know what this tastes like and whatnot. And, well, I tell you, I was awfully close to drinking that. And I was actually saved by a kind of an interesting thing. I don't know if the other guys know they were supposed to cave in under the pressure to try that one out. But one of the guys next to me said, well, Hall, since you're not going to drink that one, I'll take it. And of course, that's the way it was with a lot of us in the armed services during the war. The liquor interests and the tobacco interests. They gave you free cigarettes. One friend of mine, who I didn't see all during the war, but saw after the war, was a neighbor of mine when I was a kid. When I came home from the war, he was smoking and he was drinking. Now, his father had been an alcoholic, and he saw all the evils of these kind of things, and he used to say, boy, not for me. I am never going to touch that stuff. When I came home, there he was doing it, and I asked him how come. He says, well, they gave it all to you free, so you couldn't pass it up. Now, that seems like a strange attitude, but that probably was true of many young men, and I think the cigarette industry knew that. Cigarettes were free everywhere to servicemen. And the current buildup, an increase in the smoking of cigarettes actually occurred during World War II because the cigarette companies just passed out cigarettes to anyone in the armed services. And people took the attitude, oh, man, boy, free, how can I just not use these things? There was another way, though. My cigarette ration and other kind of rations like that were given to all service people, I just traded them to guys for things that I wanted more. And this was a way to use those kind of things. Now, we're kind of novel in the world today in that we leave all these kind of things alone. And as you know, the instructions we have on these are found in the Word of Wisdom. When I say I take pride in never having even tasted these things, I can't take too much pride in that because, as you know, in the Word of Wisdom it says, to be sent greeting, not by commandment or constraint, but by revelation and the Word of Wisdom, showing forth the order and will of God in the temporal salvation of all saints in the last days, given for a principle with promise, adapted to the capacity of the weak and the weakest of all saints, who are or who can be called saints. So, no big deal, you know. The weakest of saints. That's just showing that you're just slightly above the weakest of saints to be able to do these things. Let me tell you a little bit about the history of prohibition. During the late 1920s and the early 30s was an age when I was coming into, you know, 9, 10 years of age, more consciousness of what was going on. And I was aware that there was a big argument over letting beer come back in as something that people could have, and also whiskey and things like that, because they had been prohibited since, I believe, slightly after World War I.
How did they do that?
Well, they held... See, Roosevelt ran on a platform of many things, including the repeal of prohibition, which would allow whiskey and things like that to come back in. But in Congress, they put it on a national referendum so that everybody voted. And all of the states had to vote. 39 states had to vote for it, and then it would come back in. And then they were going to phase it back in gradually, beer first and then harder things and so on. Well, I can remember my mother being so mad at an uncle of mine. And this uncle of mine was in a bishopric, too, in our war. He was a counselor. But he was going to vote for it. Not that he was going to use it, but he thought it would be best for the people. And the church leaders do not often take a stand on, they leave us with our free agency on issues, but they certainly did take a strong stand on this and told the saints not to vote for the repeal of prohibition. Now let me tell you some of the arguments that they used to use for its repeal, at least the one that I remember the most. The idea was that we would never again have the saloon. See, the bad thing they thought about whiskey is that you'd see drunks on the street and there were saloons and bad places. Little children could go down the street carrying these things and see the brass rail you put your foot on and guys in there, you know, drinking and getting drunk. Now, that kind of activity used to be a once-a-week thing, or a once-a-paycheck thing. Man would get his paycheck either at the end of 1 week or 2 weeks of work. And then the bad thing, you see, he'd go down and he'd blow it on booze, and then his wife and kids would be left at home without money to buy food with. And this was the big tragedy of drink in those days. Well, there were not going to be any more saloons. Liquor would only be used in the home. And this was the big cry. What is wrong with a man having his whiskey to drink in his own home? The saloon is forever gone. We will never have such a thing again. Let's let liquor come back, and in the confines of a man's own home, certainly should be able to drink it. And there were a lot of arguments used like that. Another argument used was the bootlegging that was going on was bad. You'd get bad whiskey and people would be killed by it, and then the government wasn't getting their tax. You'd raise lots of money by taxing what people drank, and kinds of arguments like that. And people voted for it on that basis. And sorry to say, you know which the 39th state was who voted for it that made liquor come back?
Utah.
State of Utah. And I remember President Grant and other church leaders were just sick over that. You know, wouldn't you be if you were the president of the church? Here, your state, the state of the Latter-day Saints, was the 39th state, the one last state needed to repeal prohibition and bring these kind of things back into our lives. Well, I think that people in those days certainly did not have much foresight. Is the saloon back in our day?
Yes.
Well, certainly it's back. You go to New York City and there are 10 bars on every block. And there were other very bad things that they didn't foresee. They didn't foresee the use of liquor in driving, for example. Just didn't foresee that possibility at all. We've been reading in the newspapers recently the situation on drunk driving, and it's very bad right here in our own state. I think it was about 2 weeks ago that I read this in the Herald, so I may have forgotten the figures. But it seemed to me that they randomly sampled about 500 drivers throughout the state to see after 6 p.m. to see how many had been using liquor. And it turned out that about 40% of them had been using liquor, which is awfully high for a state in which over 50% of the people don't drink. To me, it seems that in this state, the liquor consumption being what it is, the people who do drink in the state of Utah really drink. They really guzzle. And I suppose, it's a kind of rebellion, an adult rebellion. Adults ought to be over that kind of thing. We're not going to let the Mormon church dictate us what we're going to do, you know, and they overreact, I think, and they use these things to excess. And as all of you know who have taken driver's ed or have had to go down and take a driver's test or a written test recently, they figure that over 50% of accidents that are caused come as a result of driving while you have been drinking. How many of you know, how many of you have read the driver's book for Utah recently enough that you know what the legal limit is for blood for alcohol content in your blood?
0.8.
That's right. 0.8%. However, that same book points out that this is a conservative limit, in that if a guy has that much there, he really is under the influence. I know because I just took my test. I let my driver's license lapse. In fact, the funniest darn thing, I drove over to Denver. I didn't know my driver's license had lapsed. And for some strange reason, a police, I don't know what I was doing, he stopped me as I was going down a side street, and he says he wanted to see my license. And he looked at my license and said, "Your license is expired." Yeah, he gave me a ticket for not having a proper driver's license. And I says, "Well, what do I do about this?" And he says, "Well," he assumed at first that I was a resident of Colorado, you know, who hadn't got my license at first, but he'd already given me the ticket when I found out that's what he was figuring.
You have to figure stuff like that. Oh, wow.
The other thing I he should have known better, I didn't. I was driving that little VW he just bought, and it doesn't have the license plate yet. It just has a sticker in the window, and it said Utah on it. He ought to have known I couldn't have been arrested in Colorado. But he put down he says this is the same as if you didn't have a license at all. And so he wrote down as the charge, driving without a valid Colorado driver's license. And I says, "Well, what do I do about this?" And he says, "Well, you have to," he gave me the rules. And I says, "Yeah, but I'm from Utah. I'm going back today." He says, "Well, you'll have to see the judge today." So I went through all that traffic. You know how it works when you get a ticket. Went down and saw the judge, and the judge let me off. I don't know what I was going to say when I got into this. What was I going to say? I had a point to make, not making a mistake. Sorry.
Content in the blood.
Alcohol content in the blood.
All we're learning today is that you're a rat.
Well, anyway, for that reason, when I got back here, I had to go down and take the exam, and that's why something seems to be fresh on my mind concerning alcohol in the blood. Well, it's a real bad thing in our whole country. I was talking to a Secret Service agent who comes to see me all the time. He comes to see me about science in Russia. We do have quite a bit of correspondence with people in Russia because of my work in high pressure, in which they've had a great interest for years, and he comes and sees me about once a month.
And the KGB will kidnap
him. And just to learn from us what we may have learned from correspondence and whatnot. But we got to talking about problems in Russia, and he feels he's a Russian expert. That's his area. He feels that Russia has a greater drinking problem than we have in the United States. So it must be quite bad. There is a worldwide problem with drinking. In most countries where the industrialization has come up and there's more wealth, people can afford to buy it, so they buy it.
And more pressure.
Perhaps that's true. Now in China, all the bad things there are in China, it does seem that they do not have a drinking problem.
They're drinking tea.
Opium.
Well,
cross-eyed Chinaman running down the
hall. Let me tell you some things that may be of some interest to you about alcohol. Alcohol is the major problem word of wisdom wise in the United States. No doubt cigarettes are a problem too. But for cost of all the damage that is done, automobile accidents, broken homes, people in institutions because of alcoholism and lost time at work and things like that, in an economic sense at least, the greatest problem regarding health, illnesses and that kind of thing in the United States is no doubt the use of alcohol. This is true also in other countries in the world. Let me tell you something about the alcoholics from the chemist's point of view. Those of you who've taken chemistry, what alcohol is that called?
Methyl.
That's methyl. We've got a lot of stuff like that. And what is this one?
Wood.
Okay, this is called wood alcohol also. What is this one? That's ethyl. And then as I go on up, with CH, just adding additional CH2 groups and so on. Propyl.
I didn't know that, James.
What's propyl?
It contains three carbon atoms to which hydrogen is attached before you put on the hydroxide. You see the thing that's characteristic of the alcohols? You see this OH group right here. Now we go back one step beyond this in this series, and we have HOH. And what does that stuff?
Fire water.
Water. Water, in a sense, is alcohol. It's an alcohol. It's in a series of alcohols. You know, to the chemist, that's kind of interesting. The Lord did turn water into wine, didn't he? He had it partially made. He had his hydroxyl group there, you see, to begin with. All he had to do was add CH2, and he had the ethyl, but he had to add another CH2.
Oh, you think the wine of Jesus changed this dramatic?
I don't know. I've heard that debated all kinds of ways. You know, some things have to be taken in the context of history. There is one thing about alcoholic beverages in that it kills organisms. And it may be in some areas where the water has not been sanitized that drinking alcoholic beverages has been a salvation. Sure, it cut your life short and it made you an alcoholic in the end, but over a long span, it did make your life useful. I've seen it argued that way, and I think in some instances that might have been true. I don't know whether the wine in the bottle is alcoholic or not. In the lack of sanitary conditions, refrigeration and whatnot, it probably couldn't have helped with the alcoholics. All you had to do is keep it in a warm climate for a week, and it would automatically contain some alcohol.
Yeah, but he made it right on the spot.
Yeah. Well, that was certainly one of his miracles. All right, now, which one of these is the alcohol that is in the drinking alcohol, so to speak? This one right here. What happens if you drink this one?
You die.
Wine. Wrecks your brain, and you can die. Now, when I was young, we did not have ethylene glycols for use in your automobile radiator for wintertime. Then you put this in it. And many people would drain radiators and drink that stuff. They put in these foams, in most alcohols, they
at least on cold days, he's bladder.
Have you heard the word denaturant?
Yeah.
Now that is an additive that you put in an alcohol that cannot be removed by ordinary distillation. The ordinary man, moonshiners and people like that, you know, they will boil things, pass them through copper tubes and condense them and separate things into fractions or components. And to the ordinary man, there's not much more in the way of a separation gadget that you can invent beyond a simple still. Denaturants will not separate from the alcohol during a distillation. Now, a chemist has more sophisticated things at his means, but even there, denaturants are chemical compounds that are bad. They'll make you sick or kill you or something, that are added to all kinds of alcohols to prevent you from drinking them. And then in a can where the public may have access to them, it will say denatured alcohol cannot be removed, and if you drink it, it'll kill you or do something bad. Well, you know, man always thinks that he's smarter, though, than somebody else. And when I was a kid, there was a person who lived in our ward, non-active, who decided he could make the radiator alcohol drinkable by pouring it through ashes. And he did this, and I was one of the pallbearers at his funeral. So people do need to be careful about
through ashes.
Yeah, he figured he not being an extremist of any mind, he was not only going to take out any denatured compound that might have been in there that would hurt him, but he figured it'd fix up the wood alcohol itself so it wouldn't hurt him. While they do put denaturants in this wood alcohol or methyl alcohol, it in and of itself is real bad. I don't even know why they add denaturants to that, because it in itself will kill you. Very bad. Blindness will occur on taking just small amounts of it. Right now, they have these other alcohols like Copil.
That's very good.
Propyl alcohol. And the next one, which has four carbon atoms, is called butyl. And then the one with five carbon atoms is called, what's that one called?
Myrtle.
Pentyl, I guess. Pentyl, yeah. Pentyl, 6 hexyl.
No, 7.
What's 7? Hemp?
7. Sexyl.
And then septyl, and then octyl, and then nonyl, and then decyl.
And it's kind of gone.
That's nickel.
Now they eventually get to be solid. This, you see, volatilized real easily. This is a little heavier. This is still heavier. And I think when you get up here to about pentyl, you couldn't drink the octyl. No, it has to go higher than that. Maybe it's up here about septyl or octyl. You couldn't even drink this stuff. You'd have to eat it because it's solid. But they'll all make you drunk. And the effect is stronger as you go to the higher alcohol.
You'd really,
so what kind
of if you drank propyl though, would it?
No, well, isopropyl is different. I don't want to get into the chemistry of that. The rubbing alcohol is isopropyl. That has a branched chain. Ordinary propyl is like that. Isopropyl is like this. H2OH CH3 CH3 and H. It has the same number of carbons and hydrogens, but when they get longer, you get a possibility of a different structural arrangement. And that's bad. You can't drink that. It's real bad for you. Well, now, when they make alcohol, it's made by many interesting processes. This one is made from natural gas. Natural gas is CH4, four carbon atoms. Four hydrogen atoms connected to a carbon. You partially burn it in air in the presence of an iron catalyst at about 300 atmospheres of pressure, and you put one oxygen atom in there. See? It has the same formula. Four hydrogens, one oxygen, and a carbon. So from natural gas, you can make methyl alcohol, and that's the way it's made. Very easily, very economically.
Can you cook away
alcohol? Yeah. This one is made mainly by fermentation, but not entirely. It also can be made from petroleum, a thing called ethylene, which has a double bond for you guys who have had some high school chemistry. You oxidize this, open up the double bonds, stick on another hydrogen there, and put another hydroxyl out there. So the industrial alcohol, which is made by the billions of gallons, is made from ethylene. But that you drink is made primarily from the fermentation of grain and corn and those kind of things. Now, in the fermentation process, these little bacteria do not make just one thing. In addition to making the ethyl alcohol, which the bacteria do very efficiently, they also make acetone, and they make a group of things that are called fusel oils. And these fusel oils are aldehyde. Now, have any of you ever heard about what the embalming fluid consists of?
Formaldehyde.
Formaldehyde. It's an aldehyde. And formaldehyde is one of the things that is made along with higher aldehydes in the fermentation process. Now, you've seen these ads in the news magazines for Old Crow and all the rest of them that talk about aged in these wood barrels, you know, prepared so carefully, and gives it all this marvelous flavor and makes our whiskey so good. You know why it makes their whiskey so good? The charcoal on the inside of the barrel takes out the fusel oils. It doesn't make the whiskey better, it just makes it so it won't kill you. Well, I guess that's making it better, but you know, they leave you with the wrong impression. You know, it makes it smooth as velvet, and they use a lot of other fancy words to, you know, make you enticed towards their direction. Well, that's just a kind of romantic thing. That's the way they used to do it. Now, you can do it much more efficiently nowadays. At the Fleischmann distillery back in Cincinnati or wherever else they're doing it. They just pass the stuff. Schenectady, they don't make whiskey in Schenectady.
Oh, they
make varnish in Schenectady. They don't make whiskey there. At least not legally. Well, they pass it over what is called activated charcoal. And that's much more efficient than these barrels. The barrel act that they use nowadays, aging it in the barrel, that's just romance or something. Makes it, you know, tradition. Makes it sound good so that you want to buy this stuff. Now, that's the trouble with the moonshine whiskeys that kill so many people, particularly in the southern part of the United States. The guys just have a crummy old homemade still. Now, all it is a copper pot and then a copper coil. The coil just increased the length of the copper, and it's air cooled. You know what a still is for? It's to increase the alcohol content, see? When they use potatoes or corn or anything else and make this mash and then let the just natural bacteria from the air get in it and start fermentation and make the alcohol. When the alcohol concentration gets up to about 14%, and that's the alcohol concentration in wine, the bacteria can't live in it any longer. They kill themselves.
They build up the
self-defeating, you see. Those bacteria are busy making the alcohol, and then it gets up to about the 14% level, and then they can't live in it anymore. And that's wine level. But man never being satisfied with how much alcohol he can get in his system, you don't want to increase the content. Somewhere along the line, they invented stills. And if you distill from just a single pot the stuff over, you see, it's after you filtered out the mash, it's mainly water and the ethanol along with the fusel oils and other things. But it's distilled over, and the alcohol, being more volatile, comes over in greater abundance. Water comes over too, but the alcohol comes over in the greatest abundance. So the first collection in your new jug over here will be fairly strong, perhaps as high as 50%. In alcohol. Now, if you distilled over the entire works, then you'd end up with just what you had in the pot eventually. So you have to throw away most of what is made in the old moonshiner's technique. Now, chemists have what they call multiple plate column stills.
Good old chemist.
Yeah, and a good old chemist. They can distill off and completely separate it out as 95% alcohol, not to get the thing up to 100% alcohol. A chemist has to get the last 5% of water out by a chemical reaction. He puts metallic.
You better not tell these guys.
Calcium. Calcium in the stuff, and it reacts with the water to form a white precipitate of calcium hydroxide and leaves pure alcohol behind, which the chemist will need, you see, for many of his chemical reactions. Now, I started to say that the trouble with the moonshining is that these bacteria make the acetone and the aldehydes and the higher alcohols and other materials that are bad. And their simple still has no way of getting that out. Now, they could get that out if they put in wooden kegs and age it, but they don't want to go to that trouble. And so that is the danger of moonshine whiskey. And, you know, many people have been made sick and blind and killed by use of moonshine whiskey. Well, I don't know whether those technical details are of any interest to you or not, but that's a little bit about...
I'll leave that up for next board.
You know, I have had a great interest in the Word of Wisdom. I guess I must have got it from my parents. My dad told me not to do these things. In fact, one day he told me, he says, "Trace, don't ever drink Coke," and I took him with his word. I didn't have to explain it to me or anything. I think I was obedient, but then my father, you know, I must have respected a great deal when he'd say these things to me. Now, I fell down on Coke one time on a very funny situation where I did taste it and threw the rest of it down the drain when they weren't looking, when I was in a pressured situation, which is, I'm not too proud of that. I should have, it was a social situation in which people, as a favor, had given me this Coke to drink. And I wasn't able to, you know, living in this world. Here's the problem up here. Living in the world, abstaining from these things when the rest of the world does it. And this was a problem where I couldn't turn it down. Or, you know, they'd given it to me as a favor. Suddenly just brought it in the room and everybody drinking it. And I didn't know what, I wasn't smart enough to know how to handle the situation. So, yeah, I took little sips of it. Then first chance I got, I went out and dumped the bottle out, which wasn't the thing to do, because I had a personal conviction that I shouldn't drink that stuff. Now, you heard of a former apostle who is dead now, John A. Witzel. Here's a book that I have. He was a boyhood hero of mine. He was a scientist, for one thing. He was a chemist. And there were other things that I was drawn to this man, and he was, a boyhood hero. Now, this particular book, The Word of Wisdom, A Modern Interpretation, written by John A. Witzel and also by his wife, Leah Durham Witzel. Now, this was given to me by a very wonderful Sunday school teacher I had, whose name was Ina Barnes. October 20th, 1939. Dear Trace, it's my birthday. Many happy returns of this most noted day. May success and happiness find their way to you. Yours, me. She always signed her name, me. Her name was Marian Ina Barnes. She's a very effective Sunday school teacher in the 1840s in Ogden, Utah. She started teaching the young men in that ward Sunday school at the age of 12. And they promoted her with the kids all the way until they were 20 years old. So I had this Sunday school teacher for 8 years straight. And everybody just loved her. Very effective teacher. Well, if you look through this book of mine, you'll see that I studied and underlined everything all over the place. But Apostle Witzel in this book was trying to show from scientific evidence the bad effects of using alcohol, coffee, tea and tobacco. And it's too bad that this man isn't alive today to see the greater scientific evidence that we now have with regard to cancer and smoking and other things like that. Now, He did the best he could in his day, and his arguments were sound and good. But the arguments for our day are totally convincing on the bad effect of these things. During my life, I've been fairly sickly. I nearly died a couple of times when I was young. And health has always been somewhat of a problem to me, although there have been some recent years where my health has been excellent. But during one period of my life, when I was having a lot of trouble with my health, this goes back to around 1952 and 1953, I was a district councilman in the Albany-Hudson district back in New York. Don't talk about Schenectady, David, so I want you to listen real well. The Schenectady area had more than its share of intelligent, educated young people, just newly married in the main. And we had a good branch going there. There were about 20 families when I first went there in 1948. And the strong priesthood of the area was there. And in the district, our assignment extended from the Canadian border on the north to New York City on the south. West Point, example, was our responsibility. We had a small branch at West Point, New York, the Army's Academy there. And then on the north, our furthest little group north was at a place called Plattsburgh, New York. And we traveled a total of 180 miles down to New York City going down that way. And then I guess a number of additional miles, we had about a 300 or 350 mile territory just all up and down the Hudson River and an extension of the Hudson River on north. And we used to put many, many miles on our automobiles traveling this territory. Well, I was a district councilman. See, in the mission field, this is the equivalent of high councilman. Our district president, equivalent of the state president, was a General Electric engineer by the name of Ed Ridge. And during one period, when I was having some trouble with my health, I asked that the president come in and minister to me along with one of his counselors. And I was feeling rather low, and I was, I suppose, sort of complaining. But I had taken an interest in the Word of Wisdom my entire life, a very strong interest. I'd lived it just as faithfully as I could, and yet I didn't seem to be reaping the benefits here. You remember the benefits that most of us think of first. Well, take verse 18 of section 89. And all saints will remember to keep and do these things. Walking in obedience to the commandments shall receive health in their navel and marrow to their bones. And I was thinking, you know, I'm not getting these health blessings like the promise says, and yet I've been living the things. Well, he pointed out something to me. I'd read it every day that I'd ever read this, but you know how it is. We read the scriptures and we seem to see what we want to see. We don't see all that was there. But he pointed out to me this verse, and he says, now surely you've been blessed on this part. Let's see, 19, talking about the blessings, and shall find wisdom and great treasures of knowledge, even hidden treasures. And so he emphasized that point, and I had to admit that on that, certainly I had been blessed. And then he also pointed out something that I knew too, is if I had not lived these blessings, maybe I wouldn't even be here, you know. But they certainly had blessed me in health. My health may have been fragile, but certainly without living these commandments, I may not have been here at all. I may have been dead. I may not have lived. And I know that is true. Our time is up, and I think I'd like to continue this Word of Wisdom and get more onto this practical part here, how we're going to live this Word of Wisdom in a world that does not. I have a testimony of this principle. We'll say more about it next time.
I'd like to thank Brother Hall for the lesson and for this Sunday school. Bob, could you be on the table in Sunday school and stuff?
Yeah.
Okay, and James Mayhew. Oh, that's sacrament meeting. Okay.
Sacrament?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Dave, you want to say the prayer?
Father in heaven, we hope that we'll remember the word of wisdom and the good sound knowledge and judgment that has been told us about it today. We hope that we will understand those things that have been taught to us and that we realize that our bodies are the temple of the Lord and that we should honor them. And help us to be good followers of the priesthood and we will do it. Thou, Son, Jesus Christ, we want us to do. Say this in the name of Jesus Christ.
Amen.
Remember, 3 o'clock tomorrow, we're cutting out wood.
Hey.
Don't forget.
Ida Rose is going to tell me a story now about a situation related to the Word of Wisdom.
Well, one day in Schenectady, I was talking to a friend of mine on the telephone, and she was worrying about a problem that she had let herself in for. Her husband was really going ahead in the company. He was charming young man, and he was in sales and advertising, and he was, and they really liked him, and he was going right ahead, they were quite close to his immediate boss, they were at a company party, and when they passed the cocktails around, they were just right there, and she hadn't thought of anything about it or anything, and she didn't know what to do, and so she took a cocktail. And then after she got it, she didn't know what she was going to do with it. And she says eventually she ended up dumping it in a plant. But she says, now what am I going to do, Ida Rose, when the next time comes? They saw me take...